From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And news today that the rate of undocumented immigrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border has slowed to the lowest level in decades. Univision's Enrique Acevedo will join us in a few minutes with his analysis.
But first, corruption, soccer, and politics. Russian President Vladimir Putin is among the latest world leaders to link the corruption allegations against FIFA to geopolitics. Putin is speaking out about the charges levied against top officials at World Soccer's governing body. The arrests yesterday stem from charges from the United States Justice Department. Putin says that they are a blatant attempt by the U.S. to extend its jurisdiction. He also tried to draw a parallel among the accused FIFA officials and former NSA contractor Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Meanwhile, UK Prime Minister David Cameron has called for FIFA chief Sepp Blatter to resign. But Blatter, in his first public comments since the corruption scandal broke, made the case that he should continue to lead FIFA.
Many people hold me ultimately responsible for the actions and reputation of the global football community, whether it's a decision for the hosting of a World Cup or a corruption scandal. We, or I, cannot monitor everyone all of the time.
That again is FIFA chief Sepp Blatter. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. So Vladimir Putin has weighed in. Why?
Well, Russia is going to host the 2018 World Cup, and Russia has used international sports such as the Sochi Olympics to burnish their credentials on the national stage. Putin loves this. It really works for him. In fact, I think we're trending towards a world where, given the cost of these events, maybe we'll only see the equivalent of tin pot dictators or people who had less than democratic countries being putting their hands up and saying, me, 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 give me the prestige of an event. Right after, very soon after, the Malaysian airliner was down in Ukraine and people were calling on FIFA then anew to withdraw the World Cup from Russia. FIFA, Sepp Blatter, stood by the decision. He said history has shown so far that boycotting sports events or a policy of isolation are not the effective way to solve problems. Sport, the World Cup, quote, can be a powerful catalyst for constructive dialogue. He at least says he believes that, you know, sport and having the World Cup can solve the world's problems. This is politics. This is Putin wanting to keep his World Cup. This is Sepp Blatter knowing where his allies are. And this is Putin also wanting to get a jab in at Americans. And that comparison to Snowden and to Assange is rich because whatever you think of the flaws of those guys, they at least believed in the dissemination of information, and everything about FIFA is controlling information and not letting anything out. And these guys were charged for taking bribes, having nothing to do with disseminating information.
So is there any reason that Vladimir Putin would worry that the World Cup will be moved out of Russia for 2018 or Qatar, where it's being held in 2022? I mean, is there any reason to believe it wouldn't actually happen either there or happen at all?
Well, there is a clamor for that, especially with Qatar. And Qatar has a number of problems, not the least of which was the World Cup is a summer event. And this was originally given to Qatar to take place during the summer. They have since shifted the schedule to make it take place in November, December. Temperatures only average a high in the 90s then, but Fahrenheit. But there was a report, the Garcia report, and the Garcia in question was a former United States investigator, Michael Garcia, U.S. attorney. And they issued a 350-page report. It cleared FIFA of bribery, generally cleared them of bribery in Russia and Qatar. But that whole report has never been released, and FIFA is sitting on that report. And Garcia, the eponym of the Garcia report, quit, you know, resigned because he disagreed with releasing that information. So, yeah, I don't think it will happen just because of real politics, but a lot of the countries in the world really think it should happen.
It should happen, meaning Russia should be stripped from the privilege of holding the World Cup.
Yeah, that seems, right? I mean, 2018 is, you know, 3 years away, so that might be hard to get a World Cup anew, although, you know, a nation like Germany or a nation like the Netherlands is raising its hand saying, you know, you can pick us. We could get a World Cup going in 3 years. 2022, that's certainly enough time to shift course. I think it's doubtful that FIFA will do it, but a lot depends on the election that's going on tomorrow.
Okay, and very briefly, Britain's David Cameron wants Sepp Blatter to resign, as do many others. Why is Blatter still in the driver's seat?
Oh, because he's good at politics. He's 79 years old. He's done this. This will be his fifth term. He knows where the votes are. There are many tiny, small countries that have a vote that will elect him. He has to get 105 votes, including places like Montserrat, not even a country, but they have just as much a vote as Germany or UK or the United States. So I don't think he's going anywhere, and he certainly doesn't want to resign.
Okay. Thank you. Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks again, Mike.
You're welcome.
Well, the Washington Post is reporting today that fewer immigrants are crossing the southern border and coming into the U.S. illegally than at any other time in the last two decades. It's a trend that officials from both the Obama and Bush administrations say is a result of increased border security. But what else is behind it? Univision anchor Enrique Acevedo is with us from Miami with more on this. Welcome back, Enrique.
How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing well. And what do you think is going on here? Is this just border security, or is there more happening that is causing the number of people coming into the country illegally to drop?
I think it's a number of things. The journey across Mexico is becoming extremely dangerous for immigrants. They're kidnapped, they're raped, and even killed by human trafficking organizations. Demographics are also changing. Women in Mexico and Central America are having less children. And even though economic conditions here in the U.S. are getting better, we have to remember that unemployment for Hispanics is higher than the rate for the general population, not to mention anything about growing discrimination. Recently, three undocumented immigrants were killed by police while unarmed. And there wasn't the kind of outrage that we've seen in other cases like Ferguson or Baltimore.
And you think that people are worried about that, more worried about that, and they're deciding not to come over because they don't think it's safe?
I think that's an important part of their decision. The article does a really good job explaining why border security is the answer to the wrong question. Resources should focus on trying to solve the causes of immigration and not on stopping immigrants once they're at the door. Or should I say, not only on that. Rather than viewing border enforcement as part of a broader strategy, it has become the only strategy, Jeremy. And this security-based approach has had has led to degradation in the quality of life for border communities.
But I guess the question is, what happened between last year and this year to change the situation so much? Because we were talking to you a year ago about this flood of child migrants coming across the border from Central American countries, and now all of a sudden we're at the lowest level in two decades.
Well, we had seen that before during the recession, 2007, 2010, the low levels of undocumented immigration. And the last year, we saw a spike in the number of children, and that was because of also an increase in violence in Central America. But I think that, we've been trying to shut down the border for almost half a century now, and it has had mixed results, not to mention an enormous cost, an economic cost. Since 9/11, taxpayers have paid over $100 billion in border and immigration control, and migrant deaths have steadily increased. And human trafficking organizations, like I said, mostly run by Mexican drug cartels, have seen a boom in business. So it's imperative that we stay away from this dangerous narrative of border enforcement and recognize that the largest factor driving illegal immigration to the U.S. or undocumented immigration to the U.S. is not a weak, unprotected border.
It is.
Well, the United States today spends more money each year on border and immigration control than the combined budgets of the FBI, the ATF, the DEA, the Secret Service, and the U.S. Marshals. And you still have people coming across the border.
So people are just flying in. You're saying they're flying in, they're staying here. This is not about people rushing across the U.S.-Mexico border.
I think most of the people that want to get here are people that have been living here before. You see that in the people that are detained at the border. They're usually people who are trying to come back to the U.S. to reunite with their families, people who have been living here for over a decade. So, there was this number that really struck me about border security in an article published recently in Politico. Customs and Border Protection operates a fleet of some 250 planes. We're talking about helicopters, drones, etc. CBP has the largest law enforcement air force in the world. It's roughly the equivalent of Brazil's air force. So we can keep spending billions of dollars on border enforcement, but like I said at the beginning, this answers the wrong question. The question we should be answering is, how do we solve the causes of immigration? How do we spend all this money trying to help these countries, for example, Central American countries, which we have during the Obama administration, to provide reasons for these people to stay at home. I would argue that the legalization of marijuana in the United States has done much more to lower the numbers of undocumented immigrants coming across the border than 50 years of sealant policy.
I want to get your thoughts on one other thing, Enrique, and that is that another court this week blocked President Obama's executive action on immigration that would have given several million undocumented immigrants work permits and protection from deportation. The Department of Justice says it's not going to appeal this to the Supreme Court at the moment. How is that reverberating among Hispanics in the U.S.?
Well, I think at the end of the day, Congress, specifically the House of Representatives, did block immigration reform. And despite a border security amendment that doubled the number of agents and the funding for Border Patrol, the courts have also delayed the president's immigration relief. But so Obama's legacy might end up being the record for most immigrants deported during any administration. We're talking over 2 million people now. That's exactly the opposite of what he hoped for at the beginning of his administration. And I think that's because he underestimated Republicans on this issue.
Enrique Acevedo, anchor with Univision News, joining us from Miami. Enrique, thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
How does a company go from controlling half the world's smartphone market to less than a percent? For the BlackBerry, the collapse started with a pitch for a new device called the iPhone from Apple's Steve Jobs.
An iPod, a phone, and an internet communicator. An iPod, a phone. Are you getting it?
That was in 2007, and back then, the head of research in motion, the maker of BlackBerry, had one thing to say: we'll be fine. And we now know that was wrong. Jackie McNish and Sean Silkoff tell the story of the BlackBerry's rise and fall in their new book, Losing the Signal. They're with us from Toronto. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And what was going on at Research in Motion at that time? Did they really think we'll be fine?
I think that in Silicon Valley, everyone has, you know, puts down their competitors. But what happened was behind the scenes. They looked at it. They knew the iPhone was a huge threat, but they didn't think it would happen as quickly as it did, because the iPhone had so much capacity and drained so much bandwidth that they assumed that the carriers would not be able to catch up with all the things that they wanted to offer on the iPhone, whether it was Angry Birds or YouTube videos. That was just an impossibility from BlackBerry's perspective, because they had grown up with rickety networks that couldn't even carry long messages. It took a while to download photos. What they realized, they understood that iPhone was a threat, but what they didn't understand was how much the industry was about to change and how much consumers wanted those phones, in spite of the fact that they all had to deal with dropped calls for a long time.
And when did they figure that out, that it was a threat?
Well, what happened was, after the iPhone debuted that summer of 2007, within a couple of months, Verizon, the big carrier that didn't have the iPhone because it was with AT&T, called up Research in Motion and said, basically, can you give us an iPhone killer? And the first thing Mike Lazaridis, the co-CEO, said is, well, we have a new smartphone with a keyboard. And they said, well, we'd really like a touchscreen. This was early days in touchscreen, and Mike did not like typing on glass. He didn't think anyone would like typing on glass. And so he came up with his own version of a touchscreen, which was, imagine, for those of your listeners who've never seen the Storm, the entire piece of glass is a button. So you press down and the entire piece of glass goes down. And so a virtual keyboard would appear on the screen and you would click down. That was the BlackBerry version of a touchscreen in Mike's mind. And it would give that sort of clicking sensation. So Verizon loved it. They placed the largest order BlackBerry RIM had ever gotten. They had a tight timeline, which the company was not able to meet. There was a delay. The software was buggy. And when this thing shipped out for Thanksgiving 2008, it was not met with the widespread acclaim that the company was hoping for.
Yeah, and it seemed like there were a number of products that they tried to come out with that just didn't do what they thought that they would do. Let's talk about these two guys, though, the people behind this company, Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie. Who were they?
You know, this is one of the greatest pairings of an odd couple that I think I've ever seen in my career. It's not unusual to see that in Silicon Valley. You have an innovator and a businessman. You think of Mr. Hewlett, Mr. Packard. But this one was extraordinary because they were so different. Professionally, they were aligned. You had Mike Lazaridis coming from the University of Waterloo, understanding from a high school, you know, course and teacher that if he could combine the power of computing with wireless communications, he could be part of a big revolution in communications. And he struggled above a bagel store in Waterloo, Ontario, for years trying to make a go of it. Along comes Jim Balsillie, a guy from Peterborough, Ontario, Harvard MBA educated, wants to conquer the world, and looks at Mike and says, this technology will help me crack into the market. And when there's a great story in our book about Mike saying, I want to make you my partner, but I'm not going to do that until my fiance, who became his wife, meets you. And so they met, and Ophelia, Mike's wife, walks away and said, he's a shark. And Mike Lazaridis looks at Ophelia, his fiance, and said, yeah, but he'll be my shark. And that really kind of sums up the relationship. They were so close that they would signal each other in meetings when they needed to get out or they could communicate. But there was a clear line of demarcation in the company. Jim never went into the lab. Mike never went into the finance or sales side of the business. And they were very close in business, but so different that they never even socialized personally. It's an odd thing about this company. You think of Silicon Valley and how everyone socialized. These two CEOs didn't, and the company as a rule, there weren't many social activities.
Well, and this is the thing. As I was reading this book, I'm thinking they've got their engineer, they've got their business person, but they don't have an artist. And in a way, they weren't as interested, it didn't seem anyway, as Apple in creating something that was going to change the world. They were interested in creating a product that a lot of people would want to buy.
Well, that was their masterstroke. You know, a lot of companies for years tried to put a personal communicator in people's hands. Through the 90s, you saw Apple try with a Newton. There was the Palm Pilot, which was successful for a little while. Motorola had its turn. There was the Viking Express from Ericsson. And one after another, these devices, they were too clunky. They didn't really respect how much bandwidth would be used on the network. So they were really expensive, and they were expensive to use. And what RIM realized was you could take something and really strip it down and put just a small piece of the internet and a very small function, which is email, into people's hands. And this thing just took off. It quickly took on the nickname CrackBerry. People couldn't get rid of it. And you had CEOs like Jack Welch of GE, who was raving about it on the golf course. And, of course, before long, presidents of the United States were using this.
Well, and actually, we've got a little bit of tape of President Obama. Now, this is after the fall, kind of, a BlackBerry. He's had to use this. He says the reason he has to use a BlackBerry still is because he's not allowed to have a phone that has a recording device on it. And I guess his BlackBerry does not have that, and an iPhone would. But here's what he said on Jimmy Kimmel about the BlackBerry.
I still have a BlackBerry because I can't.
One guy has a BlackBerry.
The one old guy there. Look at that.
How do you think these guys would feel if they heard that clip I just played?
I think they've heard it all before. They understand that. And, you know, Sean and I are sitting here with our BlackBerries. So there still is a niche group. And a lot of people would say that the mistake that they made was trying to be like Apple. I mean, you talked about the design and the beauty of the iPhone. Yeah. That never occurred to these guys. There was no Johnny Ive at BlackBerry. This was a company that was built by traditional engineers who believed in conservation and efficiency. To them, the iPhone was something that was beautiful and faddish that they just didn't understand.
We're speaking with Jackie McNish and Sean Silkoff, who've just written a big book about the rise and fall of BlackBerry. It's called Losing the Signal. And this name BlackBerry was not the only choice. They had a few. You write about one, Blade, that didn't go anywhere. They were talking about Strawberry. But tell us about how they picked this name.
So this firm from a famous naming firm, Lexicon, from Sausalito across the bay from San Francisco, was hired to provide a name. And they went out and they interviewed people coming off the ferry from San Fran. You know, what do you think about email? And they had names like Mega Mail and Mondo Mail, I think. And people just didn't want to hear it. This was early days of email when people are just really – email is becoming very popularized. And I guess people felt like they were just being inundated with email. So they thought, okay, we don't want a name that gets people's stress levels up. We want a name that people are going to like. So they started putting names up on the wall like Vacation and Ice Cream Sundae and Strawberry. And the principal of this naming firm looked at that word, strawberry. Something about it he liked. And then he wrote the word blackberry next to it. And they'd done a lot of research into how sounds go over with people's ears, like what sounds appeal. And the letter B somehow made people feel better. And so there's two B's in blackberry. And it just seemed to roll off the tongue. It was quick. It was efficient. It sort of matched what the BlackBerry was. Mike Lazaridis saw 40 proposed names from this company. When he saw BlackBerry, it was the only one that he liked. And he had to convince the others, as you said, with Blade. The salespeople all wanted Blade. When they focus grouped BlackBerry with people, you know, with regular users, they made fun of it. They said, what, is it named after Mr. BlackBerry? But it stuck, and it seemed to work really well for them.
Do you think there's a lesson here for any other company, for Apple even? As you have looked at the rise and fall, and this is a multi-decade rise and fall of a company that controlled half the global smartphone market, do you think, well, at some point that's going to happen to Apple?
I think Apple's in such a commanding position. I think the real lessons are probably for the startup community. I mean, there's a lot of this resonates up here, but I think it resonates a lot in places like Boston and San Francisco as well. What it takes to build a global champion. One of the lessons certainly on the rise, and we have a lot of stories in the book, is this company almost got killed so many times. And you just can't take for granted how absolutely predatory the technology space is. Nobody will give you a break. And one of the things that's interesting, and actually was one of the big differences between Jim and Mike, is that Mike, I think, really believed that if your technology is great, all good things will follow from that. Whereas Jim believed everyone is out to kill you, whether it's your suppliers, your customers, not just your rivals. I mean, you could probably trust your rival more than your best customer, it would seem sometimes. So I think that might be eye-opening for maybe a very optimistic young entrepreneur who's setting out into the world with a great idea.
Sean Silkoff and Jackie McNish, their new book is called Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
And we've got an excerpt at hereandnow.org. You can get there on your computer, your iPhone, maybe even your BlackBerry if you're one of the 1% who still has one.
With schools about to let out and summer about to move in, teenagers are looking for work. Ever since the Great Recession, teenagers have had to compete for summer jobs, not just with each other, but also with millions of older unemployed workers. But now, with the national unemployment rate down to 5.4%, the prospects are getting better for young workers. Joining us is Marilyn G. Wax, senior business editor at NPR. Marilyn, just how much better are things for young Americans who are looking for a job?
The survey showed that about 2 out of 3 teenagers, older ones that is, are going to look for work this summer. The Labor Department says that among kids who are 16 to 19, the unemployment rate is about 17%. And I know you might be thinking that sounds pretty high, but compared with the worst of the recession, say back in 2009, 2010, it was 27%. So things really are better. There was a new report today. The Labor Department had initial jobless claims, and that number is still running really low. It's down to levels that we haven't seen since about the year 2000. It did tick up a little bit today, but not enough to change economists' predictions that this job market is going to be the best we've seen since the summer of 2007.
Okay, so for those who do find jobs, what's changed, if anything, about the kind of jobs that they're pulling in?
Well, it's changed a bit for wealthier kids. The thing is that it used to be, you know, for baby boomers, there were lots of jobs for all sorts of kids and everybody could find work. Now, if you're from an affluent family, you're probably twice as likely to be able to find a job. And you might get those kinds of, you know, jobs in offices with air conditioning. But that's relatively rare for most kids. The Labor Department says still the vast majority of teens will get jobs doing what they've always done. And that's low-wage work in food service, retail stores, amusement parks, that kind of thing. That's really where the jobs are for the kids.
Yeah, and that's the only kind of AC there is when you dip into the big ice cream vat to scoop it up for somebody.
Right.
In line. Yes. So what about wages? The federal minimum is $7.25 an hour, but a lot of cities and states have raised the minimum. This month alone, Los Angeles decided to hike the local minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2020. How much is that going to affect young workers?
Well, it will affect those who do land jobs. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says more than half of all the minimum wage workers are 24 or younger. So, you know, really those kinds of higher minimums have a disproportionate impact on teenagers. And there are about 29 states and lots of cities that have moved up that minimum above where the federal level is. And a lot of retailers and private businesses, Walmart's, McDonald's, Target, they've all given across the board raises this year. But there's kind of a controversy embedded in all of this, which is that some conservatives will say that when the government or whoever enforces employers to pay more to their workers, they're going to hire less and they're going to automate more. So they say if it's that works out that way, there may actually be fewer jobs than economists now believe.
But if teenagers who do land jobs find themselves making more money because they have a higher minimum wage, isn't the idea that they're going to be spending more money and that spending will generate more jobs?
That's the idea. A lot of liberals say that when workers get more money, they can spend more on pizzas and clothes. And if sales take off in clothing stores and restaurants, those employers aren't going to turn away customers. If people are having more money to spend, they'll hire more workers to handle it.
Okay. Marilyn Giwax, Senior Business Editor with National Public Radio. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's time for a break now with the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
DeBron Thomas is host of the Crunkadelic Funk Show on WUKY out of the University of Kentucky in Lexington. He is with us from there now. DeBron, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And explain the title of your show, first of all, the Crunkadelic Funk Show. What kind of stuff do you play?
Well, the premise of the show is I play anything that is deemed funky and soulful. So yes, funk is in the name, but that does not mean that I am bound by the ties of playing funk. Anything that brings out emotion. So, like, sometimes I would play some John Coltrane or some Herbie Hancock, but then you'll also hear, you know, Funkadelic and Sly and the Family Stone, you know. And one of the things I love about this show is, especially when I get to play newer people, it's not necessarily like the same feeling as listening to, you know, Car Wash by Rolls Royce. You're like, oh man, you know, this song jams. Yeah. Or listen to somebody like Alan Stone, it's like, wow, this guy is taking what all these people did and kind of putting a new spin on it and still carrying the torch.
Well, let's listen to some of it so people can get an idea. This is from funk singer Bette Davis's 1974 album, They Say I'm Different. Here is Your Mama Wants You Back.
Can you hear your mama calling? Your mama wants you back. Can you hear your mama crying? You're the best thing she ever had. What I say, your mama wants you back. Your mama, won't you? Oh, I want you, baby, I want you.
And Bette Davis, by the way, is not someone everyone has necessarily heard of. She had some songs that got into the Billboard charts back in the 70s, but she was kind of a cult favorite. What should we know about her?
Well, mainly that she was, at the time, married to Miles Davis, and she is considered by many to be the queen of funk. She actually introduced Miles to Jimi Hendrix. And one of the great things about her music is that it comes from a kind of a raw, bluesy, gritty type sound. And for the, I guess, all intent and purposes, she was kind of Lady Gaga before Lady Gaga.
And what kind of reception do you get now playing her music today?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I get half the time it's, man, you're playing Bette Davis. And then a lot of times it's, who in the world is this and where did you find this?
All right. Well, let's get to another one that you found and you wanted us to hear. This is a take on the song California Dreamin', first recorded by the Mamas and the Papas. Here is Eddie Hazel's take on the song. I think that works.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because one of the things with Funkadelic in general, because Eddie Hazel was the original guitar player for Funkadelic, you know, the Funkadelic, the gig that they got where they decided that they wanted to kind of take things in a musical direction, they were playing somewhere, I think it was in Detroit, and the van that they had that had all their equipment in it got stolen. And they were opening for, or I guess they were playing after Vanilla Fudge. You know, You Keep Me Hanging On.
Yeah.
And they let them play on their equipment, and the rest is kind of history. So as far as I'm concerned, I think that all that stuff kind of intertwines.
Well, do you think Eddie Hazel is still relevant to funk today?
Absolutely. I mean, Eddie Hazel set the groundwork for which every guitar player that wants to play in R&B and funk followed. I mean, his session work can be found on Shaky Ground by The Temptations. You know, there's a song that he does with Bonnie Pointer where he plays a banjo solo and a six-string bass on the same song. I mean, he kind of brought things to a different level by kind of infusing rock and soul into funk, along with staying true to the gospel roots of funk as well.
All right, well, let's get to some modern funk that you wanted us to hear. This is Mark Ronson. Now, we know Mark Ronson. He's very well known for his song Uptown Funk, which is played, I think, just about every second on the radio in the United States, featuring Bruno Mars. But here's a lesser-known song. This is Heavy and Rolling, featuring Andrew Wyatt.
Start up the engine, we're heavy and rolling. A tank full of gas and the night is young. I don't know if you don't care where you're going. To the high line or the heart of the sun. My sweet companion is long as the summer. Black as the river and built to fly.
It almost sounds like something Stevie Wonder would do. What do you hear here?
Well, one of the things that sticks out to me is the fact that Mark Ronson is a guy who understands where this music comes from. So he doesn't just, you know, try to copy it. He tries to do it justice. And on drums on that song is Steve Jordan, who, you know, has had a very long career. And one of the most prominent sounds you hear is Willie Weeks playing bass. And if you're not familiar with Willie Weeks, he played with Donny Hathaway and he played with the Doobie Brothers and he's on bunch of Aretha Franklin songs, you know, so at the same time, he's paying homage while helping these other guys still kind of contribute to the new music that is being made.
And yet, I hadn't even heard of Mark Ronson until maybe late last year. Where was he all this time?
Well, Mark Ronson is actually from England, and he grew up with Sean Lennon, you know, the son of John Lennon, and he has been a producer for a really long time, actually. The song Valerie that was covered by Amy Winehouse, it was his idea for her to do that song.
Ah, that's a great song, by the way, yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of an unsung hero of Northern soul and funk.
Okay, let's get to another one. This is Jill Scott. This is You Don't Know.
Did you ever give up?
Now, this one sounds like Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because the backing band on that is the Roots. And, you know, they're from Philadelphia. They're a hip-hop band with live instrumentation. And, you know, they're currently on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. But I think one of the reasons why I picked this song was I like Jill Scott, and I think that she has a tendency to call back to some of those older sounds like Gladys Knight and Aretha Franklin and Diana Ross. But I think that this particular song, it calls back to how this, you know, there was a resurgence of funk and soul kind of between 2011 and about 2014, where it was very, very popular for it to be in the mainstream with Adele and Aloe Black and Alan Stone and all these other artists. And to me, it just makes me smile that there is a resurgence of this music in the mainstream and it's not kind of washed away with a lot of the things that you see in modern pop nowadays.
And yet you say it was between 2011 and 2014. Is that stopped or is it continuing?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's stopped. There are a lot of artists that have released new recordings. Juni Morrison, who was the keyboard player in Funkadelic and in the Ohio Players, he released a brand new record this year. Funkadelic, George Clinton, has released a 3-album disc called First You Gotta Shake the Gate that came out this year. So I think that we're seeing a upward trend. And I actually just saw this the other night. Snoop Dogg has released a song, releasing a new record that has both Stevie Wonder and Charlie Wilson from the Gap Band. So I think that there is much more attention being given to these older artists, in addition to guys like Lee Fields and Sharon Jones, who didn't necessarily make it, but are now becoming popular again.
That's DeBron Thomas, host of the Crunkadelic Funk Show on WUKY out of the University of Kentucky in Lexington. DeBron, thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on. And as I always say, keep it on the one.
It's here and now. Over the past year, there's been a string of police killings of unarmed black men from Ferguson to Baltimore, and it's prompted a national conversation about the use of force and the role of racial bias in policing. It's a discussion that's been shaped by the existence of videos that document those incidents. And as Northwest Public Radio's Rowan Moore Garrity reports, there's another conversation going on about those videos, this one inside police academies.
Russ Hicks trains police recruits at the Criminal Justice Training Center in Burien, Washington. In his office, Hicks pulls up video of an incident a student showed him just hours after it was released on YouTube.
1U1PG7.
Arizona Brazilian.
All right, one round just went out.
Today, Hicks says that real-time feedback from debates about policing in places like Ferguson or Baltimore is almost inevitable.
At the start of the class, I usually ask, how's everyone doing? And then the hands start coming up. And they'll go, sir, did you see what happened in...
That's the start of a conversation Hicks says he tries to have with students every day.
It's that important politically, which is a reality of this job, and it's important to their families. Where are we going as a police work? Why did you do this? Are they going to be put in harm's way? The families are asking the same questions as the media. They're asking the same questions as the students themselves are.
Hicks says he's seeing more and more police recruits who reflect changing attitudes toward the profession. In a recent role-playing exercise, a student playing a suspect paused to ask the officer why he was being questioned in the first place.
When I was watching the student question why, I thought, that's where we're at right now. You may have to explain a little bit of what you're doing. People are not just going to do what the police say anymore. And that's okay.
The recruit who asked why is Gregory Baker. Where he grew up, Baker says fear and suspicion of the police were taken for granted. When it comes to videos of confrontations with the police, he says his friends and family tend to have a pretty consistent point of view.
They just look at it and they think cops are bad, or that's excessive force. In class, we look at it as a way to, what can we do different?
Of course, not all America's police academies are likely to use these violent episodes as case studies for reform. Seth Stoughton worries that for some instructors, video is just an excuse to dismiss public outcry over policing.
Some of them will talk about how little the public understands the nature of policing, how poor the public is at evaluating use of force incidents.
Stoughton is a former cop who teaches law at the University of South Carolina. He says historically, police have been far too quick to brush off community concerns. But police academies have a unique opportunity to move the needle.
The police academy is where civilians start learning how to think like a police officer and act like a police officer. They're switching their identity.
So Stoughton says it makes sense to have hard conversations about community police relations during that transition. Because
after 5 or 10 or 15 years in their career as a police officer, the civilian perspective is long forgotten.
Stoughton says keeping a civilian perspective in mind can prove invaluable throughout an officer's career. But it can also alienate a recruit from the department he's about to go work for.
I don't think I have ever spoken to an officer who hasn't heard the phrase, forget what you learned at the academy. Now you're going to learn how we do it on the street. It's almost universal.
Back at the academy, Russ Hicks says most recruits sign up with their hearts in the right place.
You want to help people. You truly care about people. And we want to make sure that you're there and you stay there. Because what happens in this profession, sometimes the informal culture will pull you away from that and you become kind of cold or callous or uncaring.
Hicks says tough, honest discussion is a good way to pull back. For Here and Now, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity.
Another story we're following today, George Pataki entered the presidential race. Pataki is the 69-year-old Republican who was New York's governor on 9/11. Today in New Hampshire, he pledged to protect American freedoms, which he says are under assault from the government here and from enemies around the world.
It is to preserve and protect that freedom for future generations that I speak. It is to preserve and protect that freedom that this morning I announce I am a candidate for the Republican nomination for president of the United States.
Pataki is the son of a Hungarian immigrant. He says he will support legal immigration into the U.S. once the U.S.-Mexico border is secure, and he vows to destroy enemies overseas, including ISIS.
We will provide whatever aid is necessary to those already fighting ISIS on the ground to stop their barbarism and inhumanity. And yes, if necessary, American forces will be used to actually defeat and destroy ISIS so they can pose no threat to us here.
And without naming her, he took aim at Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton.
She speaks for the middle class. They are the party of privilege. We are the party of the middle class.
George Pataki becomes the 8th Republican officially in the race. Rick Santorum stepped in yesterday, and there are more to come. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and I have decided not to run for president this year, Lisa. This is Here and Now.